song was recorded at a jam session in a tiny crossroads coffee shop called YJ's. And the guy on the bass, the one going doom da doom, that's Brian Hicks. YJ's is where I got to know Brian Hicks. I used to serve him coffee there back in the day, and we'd talk sometimes. He was one of the gentlest, most soft-spoken customers, which is why it was always a little hard to wrap my mind around references he'd make to a checkered past. As it happens, some of his worst struggles still lie ahead, but we'll get into that later. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to get the Brian Hicks story. It'll be my first time hearing the whole story, too. Brian, good morning, and welcome to Central Standard.
It's great to be here. Good morning, Gina.
You play the upright bass, and more you also sing. Is that the full repertoire, or am I missing an instrument or two?
You're missing a few things. I don't know if you're really missing anything, but I play guitar. That was my first instrument. I used to play blues harmonica. I was a cello major in college for the 1 year that I, a very colorful year of college at Central Methodist College in Fayette, Missouri, 32 acres of Christian atmosphere. And, little piano, little this and that, you know.
So I was actually missing a lot of things. You play a lot of instruments. It sounds like there's probably a whole story of musical education in there.
Yeah. A lot of things I kind of just drifted by. You know, I always was kind of like a ship without a sail, you know, at times. And, you know, I'd get into various little things and then just sort of let them slide away. But you retain things over a period of time, and then when the time's right, you pick it up back up again. And
something I've noticed about the upright jazz bassists in Kansas City is that you guys all seem to be friends. I mean, you play with each other, you promote and recommend one another. It feels from the outside like you're almost a guild. Is that kind of unusual?
Yeah, it's kind of a guild. It's kind of a little bit of a club. But, you know, we've got it's sort of a unique job that you have in within an ensemble or there's a lot of jokes about, you know, various instruments and, you know.
What's the joke about the upright bass?
One that comes to mind is, what's the difference between a bass and a upright bass and a violin? Is the bass burns longer? that would be one. I don't have too many jokes that are coming to mind at the moment. But
yeah. But you have this unique role, and so you kind of bond over that?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I've always thought of the upright bass as being kind of the horse to the carriage, you know.
It leads.
It kind of leads, but kind of doesn't. You know, you pull a lot of weight, you know.
And there's a momentum thing to it.
There is a momentum thing, and it's one of those things where you don't necessarily notice the bass. People aren't listening to the bass. In the rock and roll world, you know, the bass player is usually the guy that plays the worst guitar. You know, the garage band starts, and there's three guitar players, and you know, the guy that's not that good starts playing the bass. And I really think that was the case in, you know, with me, because I really wanted to be a guitar player. I had this fantasy of being this, you know, like jazz guitar player at night and playing in a symphony, playing cello in a symphony during the day and, at night, early evenings, you know, and then going to my late, you know, after hours gig and playing, like Wes Montgomery or something. But
you had quite an around the clock schedule painted for yourself.
Today?
No, just this fantasy.
Oh, then, yeah, then. Oh, I did. I definitely did. I don't know where sleep, you know, played into it. And there was a time where I didn't sleep very much.
Yeah. Well, how did you first get into music?
You know, my mom and dad bought me a guitar for Christmas when I was about third or fourth grade or something like that. And I took lessons at Wyandotte County Music Center from a guy named Ray Naylor, who, as fate would have it, he was the accompanist. He and Ida Macbeth worked together maybe a few years after that. Actually more than a few years after that, because Ida and I are not that far away in age. But, you know, and I later worked with Ida. But I took lessons for a little while. I'd never practiced. I didn't, you know, I just...
Like a lot of kids in their music lessons.
Exactly. You know, and you know, so I took lessons for a few months and then just put it down for years. And then I remember one time watching something like the Mike Douglas or Merv Griffin show and seeing some kid who was about my age at the time playing the guitar. And I remember thinking that, you know, if he can do it, I can do it. You know, it was one of those kind of things. I was kind of an arrogant little cuss. And you know, so I started playing the guitar again and just would pick up various little chords and things from various sources. I had a friend of my older brother's who played guitar, and I used to get together with him and play. And my father and I used to sit in my bedroom and we'd go through this country and western greatest hits book. And
like a sheet music or
just sheet music. And my dad played some guitar. He would tune my guitar for me when I didn't know how to tune it. And he played a little harmonica, and he always sang. And
but you were singing country music and playing country music back then?
Yeah,
when did the whole jazz thing happen?
When I was in junior high school, my sister Kathy met the man who she would marry and who would adopt my two nieces. And his name was Kenny Ricker, and his brother was Bruce Ricker, who made the last of the Blue Devils movie and ran Rhapsody Films out of New York City. He was teaching at the law school at that time, and he was a big jazz fan. And I was really into like country rock and country blues, you know, at the time. And he said, "You've got to start listening to jazz." And he loaned me, maybe 10 or 15 records. And the one that, there were two of them that really came to mind. One was a Kenny Burrell record. And then there was a Jimmy Smith record. And then there's some Charlie Parker. And at the time, I couldn't relate to Charlie Parker. But the Kenny Burrell and Jimmy Smith, I could really latch onto. And Kenny Burrell was probably the first jazz artists that I could actually just listen to a few notes and identify him by his sound.
What do you think it was about his sound that you connected to so much? Can you put your finger on it? Do you remember that experience of like falling in love with that stuff?
Yeah, it was the blues. It was blues. And it was a different kind of blues than I was accustomed to. You know, I remember going to the Foundation when I was in junior high school.
In junior high school?
Yeah.
You were advanced.
Well, yeah, I shouldn't have been there. But I was, and it was, it changed my life, really, in a lot of, you know, it affected me in so many ways throughout my life, and, you know, mostly good. Some of it, I took away the wrong things at various times. But musically... good grief, you know, it was a lot to take in. And I remember listening to Sonny Kenner and seeing him play a blues. And for me, you know, I was listening to like Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and, The Lovin' Spoonful and, you know, Eric Burdon and stuff like that. And And I remember, you know, watching him change chords, you know, every two bars. You know, he'd have a different, you know, he'd have all these passing chords, and I just did not understand that at all, but I wanted to, you know, I really wanted to. And
it was totally new to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was just opened up a whole new world of music and life, really, you know, that whole scene.
Yeah, describe the scene to me a little bit more. I mean, what years are we talking about when you're in junior high?
Oh, I guess that would have been about 1973 to about 75 or 6. You know, those were like the fat years for me, you know, being down there with my, at that time in my life, you know, being in, you know, adolescence and, you know, just the world getting bigger and expanding and, you know, my curiosity just increasing and, you know, and then just being at the foundation and just seeing all that grooviness happening, you know, and it was like a weird fantasy kind of world that I just, man, I went for it.
Can you describe the grooviness in a little more detail?
Oh, gosh. Well, one of the first things that hit me was the booze and pot. You know,
yeah,
it did. It hit me really. You know, that was something that I took to like a duck to water.
Just stuff being passed around.
Oh yeah, just stuff being passed around, and I was always a little insecure and a little afraid, a lot afraid, you know, and everything. But you know, I noticed that those things made me less insecure and less afraid, and times when I probably should have been a little more afraid.
Yeah. But, you grew up in KCK, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So whereabouts in KCK?
About 78th and 2962 North 78th Place, right off Leavenworth Road.
Set the scene for me. Take me to your Kansas City, Kansas in the 1960s, 1970s.
Oh, man. I had a lot of kids in the neighborhood, a lot of friends. I had these two twins that lived next door to me that were a year older than me, and we were buddies. Had kids across the street, kids up the street, you know, just kids all over the place.
Would you consider the environment a really urban environment where you were?
In KCK?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, it was suburban. It was all, you know, it was, we were like kind of on the outskirts of Western Wyandotte County at that time, you know, because there wasn't, you know, like the legends and all that, wasn't even a...
not a glimmer in anyone's eye.
No. No one had any idea that there'd be a, you know, all of that stuff. You know, Wyandotte County Lake, you know, was a, that was like going out in the country. And,
So very shortly after that, you made a move to a pretty different setting. I mean, when I think about you in junior high going to the Mutual Musicians Foundation over on 18th Street, off of 18th Street, late at night, hearing Sonny Kenner play, getting your first whiffs of all kinds of intoxicants, I imagine this move that your family makes to a very rural setting would have been pretty jarring. Where did you go and why were you going there?
We went to I'm the youngest of five. There were four of us. My oldest sister passed away when I was 13. Everyone had moved out of the house. I was the only one living at home. And my father's work situation had changed. He had been a superintendent of a container company in North Kansas City, and they went out of business, and he kind of got a raw deal on that. I mean, he, you know, just was left with nothing, and he tried to do real estate, and this was, you know, in the mid-70s. It wasn't a real good time to be doing that, and he and my mother just decided they were going to go back to the country. They're both... country folk, you know, farm people. And I remember them. They asked me if I would object, and I said no. You know, that's fine. It just sounded kind of exciting to me, but it was also sort of a fantasy that I didn't really think through. But I also just wanted them to do what they wanted to. I don't know if that's true. I think it was just, yeah, fine, let's go. And we went to El Dorado Springs, Missouri. And we lived on a farm between Stockton, El Dorado Springs, and Osceola. And we were right on the Sac River. I could almost throw a rock from my front porch, land in the river. And man, it was a shock. It was a real shock to me, you know. And at that time in my life, I was at Washington High School. I didn't, you know, I was into music, but what I was really into at Washington in school was I was into theater. I really dug theater. I was in a lot of plays. And then I got to El Dorado Springs, and, you know, I went through this long summer of just not knowing anybody. And then the people I met were just kind of, you know, different. It was just that rural life wasn't what I was used to. And so I made friends with some people, you know, I made friends with some guys that were other transplants. You know, there was a guy from Kansas City who had moved there with his family, and a couple of guys from St. Louis, a guy from Sacramento, you know, and we were kind of like the misfits. But I also made friends with people there over a period of time. I adjusted, and you know, it was fine. But there was never any doubt in my mind that I was going to split as soon as possible. And, you know, you know, it wasn't like a place that I really. Now I did in later years go back and stay with my folks a few times, and that was out of necessity because of decisions that, you know, lifestyle choices.
Yeah, and I mean, it sounds like we're already starting to dive into some of those lifestyle choices as early as junior high. I mean, these visits to the foundation late at night. And when you split from El Dorado Springs, where did you go? I mean,
I went to college.
Tell me the story of those late teen, early adult years as that next chapter of adventure.
I went to college at Central Methodist College. You know, I went there, had a friend that from El Dorado Springs who was there, and he was in the music department there. And there, I had taken some lessons with a guitar player named Dick Crockett, who lives in town now. We play together from time to time. And, you know, I just decided that's where I wanted to go, and I got a scholarship, a cello scholarship, to go there. They didn't really have a string program per se. They didn't really have an orchestra or anything, and you know, but they had a pretty good jazz band. Ron Anson, this bear guy, came out of North Texas. Bob Bowman knew him at North Texas. Bob's a good friend, and Crockett and Bear were good buddies, and so they had this, like, you know, beautiful little jazz program there, and. Yeah, I was there living in this athletic dorm. You know, it was like the one dorm where all the football players and rugby players and basketball players lived. I don't know why. Well, I do know why, because Jimmy, my drummer friend, lived there, and he said that was the hippest dorm. And so that's where I went. And it was a good year. I didn't make good use of it, you know, so I drank a lot. I joined two fraternities.
you were drinking a lot at the beginning of college.
I was drinking a lot when I was 13 or 14.
What was going on? Why do you think you were doing that stuff?
It made me brave. You know, I could talk to girls. I could talk to guys, you know. I mean, I wasn't intimidated by, you know, when I had just the right amount of, you know, just that, what was it Paul Newman said in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, you know, he was just enough to hear that click. If I could get to that point, it was like I could do no wrong. But the challenge was always to not go beyond that point. And I always, from the day I, you know, began, I always wanted more, always wanted more.
You mentioned earlier, I mean, I definitely don't mean to play armchair psychologist or anything, but you mentioned earlier that when you were 13, your older sister died. Is that something that was weighing on you?
Oh, I don't say it was weighing on me, you know, because I think about that a lot. I think about life's travails, you know, I mean, and you know, what, you know, why am I like I am? Why, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, it was just a thing. But what it did, I will say that it just opened my mind up to a new possibility. You know, and it wasn't something that was completely remote to me, because I've always thought about that, those kind of things, you know, death and losing people and, you know, just all of that stuff, you know, just the, how fleeting everything is, relationships. That's always been on my mind. That was just a transitional period for me.
Yeah.
It wasn't long after she passed away that a couple of friends that were very significant friends to me called me up to come over to a little, like, little small gathering of them at this one guy's mother's house. And, you know, we were just teenagers, and she wasn't there, and she wasn't there a lot. So that was where we kind of all gathered, and we'd listen to Doobie Brothers and, you know, hang around in the black light with, you know, with a black light or strobe lights and just dream, you know, but we'd always get high and drink if we could.
When you went to college for 1 year, and from there, it seems like you kind of went off the tracks a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Can you describe what happened then?
You know, I just kind of ran out of money and, you know, ran out of, you know, I didn't really want to be a college graduate so much as I just wanted to get on with things. And plus, I didn't follow through. There's been a big story of my life is not following through with things. But in this instance, you know, the school year ended. I probably didn't do the paperwork that was necessary to, you know, set things up for the next year. I ended up like hitchhiking to Columbia, Missouri, and I just kind of got settled into a little scene there, you know, did the, kind of the same stuff. And then came to Kansas City about 8 months later.
Brian Hicks, hold that thought. KCUR's Central Standard has to take a short break, but we'll get right back to this portrait session with Kansas City jazz musician Brian Hicks. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us. Welcome back to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with musician Brian Hicks. He's the subject of today's portrait session. That's an in-depth, hour-long interview with one of the characters who makes Kansas City an interesting place to live. Brian's been telling us about his KCK childhood, followed by culture shock when his family moved to rural Missouri, falling in love with jazz, ditching college to hitchhike, make music, maybe get in some trouble. Is that a fair synopsis, Brian?
Oh, yeah.
How bad did it get for you? I mean, you were talking about that by college, you're drinking a lot. Even by junior high, you're drinking a lot.
Oh, I never felt like it was bad at that time, you know.
That wasn't the way you experienced it?
No, that's not the way it came across to me. It just seemed, you know, it was getting to be normal. You know, and every once in a while, I always kind of felt like I was an alcoholic, but I thought, you know, all right, you know, that's fine. I can, you know, some fine people are alcoholics, you know, I mean, some, you know, and I felt like it kind of went hand in hand with being a genius.
That is really interesting because we had a conversation on this show not too long ago about the relationship between drugs and the arts. I mean, all kinds of mind-altering substances and the arts viewed really broadly, like from painting to writing to, yeah, jazz. And there does seem to be a relationship, but there's also so much mythology and romanticizing around what that relationship is that it's really hard to identify, yeah, the nature of it. How, what would you say about the relationship between creativity and mind-altering substances for you?
Oh, for me, it was a bunch of garbage. It was a smokescreen. Looking back on it, I remember hearing Raymond Carver talking about, you know, he and John Cheever, you know, hanging out together and just drinking. And, you know, they never took the cover off their typewriter. But they were both convinced that the drinking was a necessary part of being, you know, these geniuses that they, you know, they so wanted to be. And you know, I don't know. Maybe they were, maybe they weren't. You know, it doesn't really matter. You know, it just matters what you do. And, you know, I spent a lot of time, I wasted a lot of time drinking and doing drugs and chasing girls and you know, just everything but honing my craft.
What made you realize or just decide that help was something that would benefit you?
What made me realize? You know, it's been a long struggle trying to put it down, you know, trying to find some direction. I can say that I realized it long ago, that I, you know, but that's not true. I realized that I needed help when I finally realized I was going to die, and that my actions affected more people than just me. You know, I was about to have a big impact on you know, a big negative impact on a whole bunch of folks.
Realizing that you were going to die, I mean, can you take me to that place with you? What was going on? What made you look around and say, this is clearly where I'm headed?
I've had to have medical detoxes for a number of years because of seizures, you know, and a strange thing about alcohol is, you know, it's one of the few things where you can, you know, your heart can stop pretty quickly. I mean, there are some painful detoxes with other drugs, but alcohol, it's the detox is pretty radical, you know, if you're the kind of alcoholic that I am. You know, so I just started having seizures, and then I had nerve damage. You know, I lost the use of my left arm, and at one point for about a year, the year that I was on the street, couldn't really lift my hand. Maybe 15 years prior to that, the same thing had happened to my left foot. Well, I saw all of this stuff, you know, and just thought, all right, well, you know, I'm pretty, you know, pretty serious. And I almost wore it as a badge, you know. It was almost something that I was proud of, that I had achieved this level of, you know, hardcoreness and everything. But then the last time I was drinking, and I had regurgitated my first drinks many, many times, you know, where I'd had to kind of get used to the idea of that first drink in the morning. But then it started throwing up blood, and besides being, you know, just my age, you know, it didn't take a rocket scientist to realize that, you know, it's dying time.
You have gone through recovery twice, I understand it, or more.
Oh, many more.
More.
Many more. I've been to treatment many times. I've had many, many detoxes. I can't even count them all.
In the period where I met you, you were sober and had had some experiences in your past that you had bounced back from, and you were you were going to relapse again at that time. Of course, like, I don't think either of us knew that. But can you talk to me about getting to where you were when I met you? I mean, did music play a big role in that? Because when I met you, I would definitely say your craft was a pretty big part of your life.
Oh, yeah. It always has been. When I'm in my right mind, yes, it is. There was a time when I, you know, I could even be into the depths of my alcoholism and, well, not in the depths of my alcoholism. I could be somewhere in there and still maintain some interest in what, in my passion, in what brought me joy. But as my alcoholism progressed, there was no joy. You know, the last few bouts that I had with my alcoholism, you know, when I was in the depths of it, you know, as it kept getting, my bottom kept getting lower and lower, I couldn't even think about music. It was just, it just was so depressing and so shameful, you know.
You were, and you were homeless during this period where, I mean, we're in the 2000s at this point, and you've had some successes by then in your musical career,
yeah,
and really been very established in Kansas City's arts and music scene. And what is it that happened that time? Because it seems like it did take you to kind of a new low.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it did. Well, I'll tell you what. I had met my wife and my daughter. I knew my wife before that. But we started to become what we are now, you know, as a family. And there was another shock, you know, that I think I had sort of accepted that after 40 years old, that I'd probably die a bachelor, you know, or just live my life, the rest of my life as, you know, I don't want to bring death into it all the time, but, you know, that I was just probably not going to have children. And all of a sudden I was confronted with this, like, you know, 2 or 3 year old little girl. And I didn't know what to do or what to think. You know, it was like, my whole image of myself and what I was, which was skewed anyway, you know, it was just all kind of a fantasy. All of a sudden I'm a dad, and it took me a number of years and, you know, some real crap to actually accept that role, you know, and sign on and just do it. And just love came, you know, had to play a part in that, you know, just devotion and selflessness, you know, and then there's a certain kind of ego deflation that has to take place to be a dad. And I wasn't ready for it. I wasn't ready. I was way too selfish. Way too selfish.
So do you think you kind of acted out?
Oh, I definitely acted out, you know. And it hurt. I mean, I learned the hard way. I'm a guy that kind of, I guess, I have always had to learn the hard way.
You, I mean, you've mentioned that you ended up on the street. I've never been homeless. I'm guessing a lot of our listeners have never been homeless. And I asked you earlier in the show to describe the Kansas City you knew as a kid growing up. Can you describe the Kansas City you knew when you were homeless in the 2000s?
Oh, well, that would have been about 2007, I guess. 2006, 2007, it's hard to remember. It was just dirty. I was dirty. I was just always dirty. I saw a lot of sidewalks, a lot of cracks in sidewalks, because my head was always down. I was always looking for change or a half full beer. I spent a lot of time in around Westport. Or a, you know, piece of pizza that somebody had dropped. That wasn't my first priority, though. It was the half full beer or a $20 bill. I had, you know, homeless clothes on. Everything was baggy. And, you know, eventually I ended up in the hospital a lot. And that was always like going to a resort. You know, if I could manage to get into Truman or someplace, at least I could watch TV for a few days.
What brought you back from this? I mean, it's almost unbelievable that you were able to come back to where you are now from where you were when you're this position that you're describing.
I've been asked that a lot. What brought me back? And it wasn't any kind of big epiphany or, you know, spiritual awakening. It was, I was just tired of it, you know, and I just realized, you know, I had some realization that, you know, I wasn't going to kill myself. I might just die, but it wasn't going to happen soon, and it wasn't going to be pretty, and it wasn't going to be easy, and that, you know, and I've got this wife and daughter that are just waiting for me to, you know, to get it together and come back home. And so I did.
What was it like to reunite with them? I mean, how did they take that? How did all of you handle that?
Well, my daughter was young enough that I don't think, you know, I think she was just happy to be, you know, to have, you know, we liked each other. And we're kind of falling in love with each other. My wife was nervous, understandably, you know. And that's a kind of nervousness that doesn't go away because, you know, one tends to anticipate what one has known, you know.
You also reunited with your mother, and I understand that you reunited her with her just in time.
Yeah, I saw her one, you know, when I was on the street, I didn't think I'd ever see anybody in my family again. And I had kind of gotten used to that idea, you know, it was just something I just sort of tucked away in some little cubby hole in the back of my addled brain. And so when I sobered up, I you know, I don't know what she was told. She was in a nursing facility. She'd had a stroke some years before, and I saw her once right before Thanksgiving, right after I'd sobered up, and then she passed away November 30th.
You wrote a song after your mom died, and I want to listen to some of it now. It's called November. Let's listen to November by Brian Hicks.
Morning, mid-autumn, awaken to still life dawn. Etched in abstract like the frost on the pane. Another sad November still refrain. Reflect in the silence lay. Brian,
does family mean something different to you now than it did before all of this happened?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, I've lost both my folks in the last 5 or 6 years, and so I've reached this milestone in my life where I'm, you know, suddenly. I'm homeless again.
In the sense of not having parents.
of not having that parents, you know, that home. There's a Loudon Wainwright song called Homeless, and, you know, it was after his mother died. And, you know, it was, you know, there's always a place that you call home. And it, for me, it was always mom and dad's.
When we talked about coming back from homelessness, we talked about why, but not so much how. I mean, you came home to your wife and daughter. Is that all it took, or did it take something more than that, some greater action? Or it seems to me that that transition has to be huge.
No, it was huge. It was, you know, one day I was looking for a doorway to sleep in and stealing, you know, vodka from Sunfresh, and, you know, and then a week later I'm sleeping in a bed and you know, and walking Jordan to the park.
That's your daughter.
That's my daughter. And, you know, yeah, that was huge. You know, there was times it was like just unbelievable. And I sort of, at the time, I kind of made a deal with God that I would be, you know, a good dad and not drink for, in exchange for something else. But, you know, it really, you know, I felt like, you know, being a dad and, you know, just, you know, okay, I'm going to be selfless now. Now I'm going to be, you know. And that was some fail-safe, you know.
To serve someone other than yourself.
Kind of, yeah. You know, and it was a good start. It was definitely a good start.
But I get the idea that's not how you see fatherhood now.
I do see fatherhood now, but I mean, as it pertains to keeping me sober and useful, that's not all that wasn't all that I had to do. You know, there was a lot more probing that needed to be done.
KCUR's Central Standard is off to one last break. When we return, we'll find out a little more about that probing and more about the music Brian's creating and performing around town right now. That's in just a minute. Don't go away. And we're back. This is a portrait session where KCUR's Central Standard pairs an in-depth interview with a photographic portrait by Paul Andrews. We'll have the whole package available online early next week. Today's subject is Brian Hicks. We've been traveling with him on his journey from addiction and homelessness to recovery and fatherhood. Hi again, Brian.
Hi.
I want to talk to you a little bit more about what you were just saying, that it took some more probing to get more probing than the pact you made with God, that if you would be a good father, you would be somehow protected and in exchange for something else, as you put it, that you kind of moved beyond that point on some level.
Yeah. You know, I just thought that if I didn't drink, everything would be fine. You know, that was all that was wrong with me. And, I've learned that that's not the case. That I have a lot of habits of thought habits that are deeply ingrained in me. And that I had to confront those things and be very honest about it. To myself, just really look in the mirror.
What has been the role of music in your recovery?
Well, it sure is sweet. You know, it's my recovery is my life. My life is my recovery. And music is, you know, to me, it's a manifestation of God to me. You know, when I was young, music was a way to impress people. It was a way to receive some kind of affirmation from people, some that applause and just the attention. You know, I wanted to be told how special I was.
What is it for you now?
It's God.
That's a simple answer.
Yeah.
I want to hear another short clip of your music. This is a song called Lady Day and John Coltrane. Is there anything you want people to know about this before they hear it?
Oh, man, it's... this song, you know, it pulled me out of a lot of scrapes. I don't know why this song in particular, but it just, you know, that's just how it's happened. It's nothing magical, but it is magical, you know, to me. It's music in my life, in a messed up life. It's what music can be.
Let's give it a listen.
Down and out, you don't know just what to do. Living all of your days in darkness, let the sun shine through. Ever feel that somehow, somewhere you lost your way? And if you don't get help quick, you won't make it through the day.
Those seem like pretty resonant lyrics. And the song, you know, this is a song that, you know, we just heard the name John Coltrane. Do you see yourself as part of some kind of continuum with a whole history of jazz in any way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, not that it's good company to be in. It's a good group of people to be somewhere in the middle of. And that's been kind of key to just being happy to be doing what I'm doing, is that
you're part of this thing that's so big.
Yeah. And it's huge, and I'm lucky. I'm just a lucky guy, man, you know, to be doing what I do. And
you're in a few different groups now. What are the groups you perform in?
Well, I've got my little thing at YJ's. I've been at Sundays doing Sundays at YJ's for a long time.
The jam sessions.
The jam sessions down there. And I've had various personnel in that group. Right now, it's Matt Leifer, Alyssa Murray, and Jeff Shirley. And that's the core group. And then I've been with Rich Hill and Kathleen Holman. We have a vocal group, which is kind of a Lambert Hendrickson Ross doing like jazz vocals.
Harmonizing.
Yeah. Scott Easterday has reformed his group, the Expassionates. I did a CD with him about 17 years ago. And then other various things. I'm doing a thing tonight at Unity on the Plaza for John Blagan and Alice Blagan, Songs of Good Cheer. And the Carol Fest on Sunday at Community Christian Church.
So yeah, you've got a lot of gigs. Brian Hicks, it has been incredible hearing your story. Thank you so much for your openness and for spending this time with me today, because you've got a hugely busy weekend, as you've just said.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It's an honor being here. It really is.
You can hear Brian play in tonight's performance at Unity Temple called Songs of Good Cheer. And we're headed out listening to an original song he wrote called Powder Dreams. It's on the second edition of I Heard It on 18th Street, put out in 2010. You can listen back to this conversation later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. And we'll have Brian's story written up along with photos by Paul Andrews, as always with our portrait sessions, early next week. So check that out too. Monday, a chat with the author of Bread, Wine, Chocolate, The Slow Loss of Foods We Love. Tune in for that. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, with Fridays by Jen Chen. We get help from Kyle Smith, our intern, and contributor Andrea Tudhope. Our music is by Spoonbender Labs, though you're not hearing it now. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.